John chapter 11 is where we'll be focusing our attention. In fact, we'll be spending all our time in this place, although we'll have some references to some other parts of the New Testament. So good to see you and to be with you this morning. This is the part of our worship where we open God's Word and we try to study and learn God's will for us, what God has revealed through the pages of Scripture, and what He wants for you and me to do today. We welcome those who are visiting with us. We want to invite you to the study of this book and to any questions it might raise in your life, especially some of the things that I have to say today may raise questions about the way you're living, may raise questions about your hope for the future. And so I would encourage you to entertain those for yourself, and if we can help you, to reach out to us. But we're glad that you're here and that you've joined us in this time of worship. I want to remind you before I get started about the college weekend, which will be actually a week from Friday. On Friday night, David Banning and Jeff Wilson will be here to work with our college group. And the idea there is we're engaging with some difficult questions so that our college kids can be equipped to engage with their friends and maybe some of their own questions. And so that'll be Friday night and Saturday night. And also on Sunday, 2 weeks from today, Brother Jeff will be staying over and preaching for us in the assembly hour. So all of us will get to hear from him at that time. John chapter 11, verse 17, the text says, "Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, 'Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died.'" And again in verse 32, it says, "When Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, 'Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died.'" So Jesus comes to these mourning sisters, mourning their brother Lazarus. They sent to Jesus, "Come help us," but he did not come. Now their brother is dead. And they both say the same thing: "If you had been here, my brother would not have died." Note the tone, though. The tone is, you probably could have done something to prevent this, but now it's too late. Nothing can be done now. The line has been crossed. Everything is settled. It reminds me of this story in Mark 5 and verse 35. While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" They've sent to Jesus. He's walking to the house. And yet now as he's coming and he gets stopped along the way to do another healing, they say, "Look, there's no point now. The line has been crossed and it won't be uncrossed." So these people have confidence in Jesus' ability to heal up to a point. Yes, you can heal until the point of death. And after death, no one can do anything. And we still feel that way, don't we? We live that way. We say, when someone is sick, maybe very sick, maybe near death, we'll say, "I'll pray for you." And we do. But there comes a point where they pass away and we don't pray anymore. We know that that line has been crossed and there's no coming back. That's why Jesus raising Lazarus is so very shocking. Because death is what we're going to call this morning the last frontier. It is the place where no one can seem to reach. Even the people of Jesus' day think he cannot reach. And yet this miracle and several others, including Jesus' own resurrection, prove that his power extends even past death. We're in the middle of a series, as I've mentioned in the last few weeks, examining some of Jesus' healings, because I want us to give more attention to some of the things that we're very comfortable and familiar with so that we can especially grow deeper and learn deeper the truths that they reveal about him and about ourselves. And so this morning, we're going to talk about death. Death appears to be the end. Death is the appointment that none of us can put off. And yet Jesus shows us a different way to think about death, both our own death and the deaths of those that we love. And I want us to consider this story and think those things for a few minutes this morning. Let's look in verse 1 of John 11. John 11 and verse 1. "Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent to him, saying, 'Lord, he whom you love is ill.' But when Jesus heard it, he said, 'This illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it.'" So Jesus knows Mary and Martha and Lazarus well. They show up in other stories in the Gospels, and John even says here, this is that Mary, verse 2, who anointed the Lord with ointment, which is something he hasn't even described yet in his gospel. But there were a lot of Marys floating around in this time. And so he says it was that Mary. That's the same Mary who now he's dealing with because her brother is dead, or he is sick and about to die. Verse 4, Jesus says that this illness doesn't lead to death, which is an ironic statement when we learn what all is going to happen, but it is for the glory of God. God's going to reveal his glory through Lazarus's sickness. Verse 5, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Now, if those two sentences read weirdly to you, they should. It says, now Jesus loved them, so when he heard he was sick, he stayed where he was. He didn't go to them. And there is a reason for that, and yet it's a little counterintuitive. John points out that it is Jesus' love that explains his actions. He loved them, so he stayed, because there's going to be a greater good that Jesus will accomplish for Lazarus and his family by staying away than just going and healing him. Verse 7. Then after this, he said to the disciples, let us go to Judea again. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again? So the disciples are a little skittish because back in John 10, the last time they were down in that area, they had tried to stone Jesus for blasphemy. And so they're a little uneasy about the possibility. So Jesus says, verse 9, are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. And that's one of Jesus' really odd, sort of enigmatic sayings where he's talking about light, and he's talking about walking, and we have a hard time figuring out what he's saying. I think what he is saying, I'll just give you my think-sos, and if you have a different idea, we can talk about it later. But I believe what he's saying is that in the same way that there are 12 hours in a day and that the light is in those 12 hours, so he says, I've got a certain time, I'm here to do my work, and if I walk in the day and in the light, I don't stumble. But in this context, I think what he seems to be saying is, if I go down to Bethany and heal or raise Lazarus, I'm walking in my Father's light, I'm doing this work, God's not going to let me be killed before the time is right. I believe he's saying I'm following the Father's will, and so I know I'm safe. And I think he's encouraging them, hey guys, it's going to be okay. I know that there'll be a point where I die, but this is not it. Verse 11. After saying these things, he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him. And the disciples said to him, Lord, if he's fallen asleep, he will recover. Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought he had meant taking rest in sleep. And Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus has died. And for your sake, I am glad that I was not there so that you may believe. But let us go to him. So Thomas called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us go also that we may die with him. So here you've got that good old misunderstanding between Jesus and his disciples. He says, well, Lazarus is asleep. And they say, oh, well, don't worry about it. Then he'll wake up, because they're scared of going. They don't want to go. And Jesus finally has to be super blunt with them and say, look, Lazarus is dead. Got it? But he also says something interesting, verse 15. For your sake, I'm glad that I was not there so that you may believe. There's going to be good that comes from that, especially there's going to be good in the development of the disciples' faith. You're going to believe because I wasn't there, and that's good. So I'm kind of glad. He says, I am glad. Did you hear it? He says, this man has died, and I love him, but I am glad. Again, this strikes us as odd, but I just want to say, how seriously must Jesus take our faith? If he is willing to say that when someone else suffers and perhaps dies, that it might be good because it might build faith in us. I wonder if we take our own faith and opportunities to grow in our faith nearly as seriously as Jesus does. Let's keep reading. Verse 17. Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus has already been in the tomb 4 days. Several scholars point out that there was a Jewish tradition that the spirit, after a person died, the spirit hovered near the body for 3 days. And that was a sort of a Jewish superstition. And here we have a man who has already been in the tomb, probably buried the day he died, but he's been in the tomb for 4 days. So no one is thinking this is some sort of resuscitation. No one is thinking, oh, well, that's understandable. This man is dead beyond dispute and beyond doubt. Verse 18, Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated at the house. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. So Martha comes out to meet Jesus. Mary doesn't. I kind of wonder if Mary wasn't mad at it, because Mary's going to have a little different behavior a little later in the chapter too. But Martha comes to him and she says, you could have healed my brother if you had just shown up when we called you. If you had been here, my brother would not have died. And yet, she says something that sounds a little like Martha might be expecting a resurrection. In verse 22, I want you to notice this because I think this is important. In verse 22, she says, but even now, I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. It sounds like she's saying, Jesus, you can raise him if you want. I don't think that's the case. And the main reason I don't think Martha is saying, come raise my brother, is because when they go to the tomb, and Jesus says, take away the stone from the tomb, Martha says, no. Martha says, he's going to stink. I don't think Martha is thinking, yeah, let's do this right now. She's not gung-ho when it comes down to it. I think instead what's happening is Martha is saying, look, Jesus, you didn't show up, but even now, I still have confidence in you. I think God still listens to you. I think you're still the one we need to follow. I'm disappointed. I'm a little frustrated. I don't understand why you didn't come. But even now, I know that God still listens to you. So I'm still on board, even though Mary may have her own questions and issues at the moment. Verse 23. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world. So Jesus promises your brother's going to rise again. And Martha seems to take that in a way that we often do when people at funerals say things like, someday we'll see them again. Your brother will rise again someday. And it's very nebulous. We're not exactly sure what we're referring to. Martha says, yes, verse 24, yeah, he'll rise again at the resurrection at the last day. Someday we'll see him again. Someday he'll rise. That's not what Jesus has in mind specifically. What Jesus wants to do is instead to push Martha to a different level of faith in him. Look again at verse 25. He says, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet he shall live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? Jesus says, this is not just about someday he's going to live again. This is about me being the key, me, the man you see in front of you, Jesus, being the key to him living again now and later, that I am the resurrection and the life. I hold this power. I give life to whom I will. I do. I am the true vine who gives life to the branches. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the good shepherd who gives life and gives it abundantly. This is me. Do you believe that? And I'm not sure Martha entirely gets it, because in verse 27, she makes a good confession. She says, you're the Christ, the Son of God, who's coming into the world. That's a great confession. That's what you and I confess. And yet, I'm not sure she's totally getting what he's saying about himself being the resurrection and the life. Verse 28. When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, the teacher is here and is calling for you. And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. She says the same thing. They seem to know he waited to come, and they are disappointed by it. Verse 33, when Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, where have you laid him? They said to him, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying?" So Jesus sees Mary, and he sees all these mourning Jews who are coming with her, and it affects him. Sometimes, when we see people we care about, it's not our grief, but watching them grieve that is overwhelming to us. And it is for Jesus. But there is an interesting wrinkle, because this word, it is in verse 33. My version says he was deeply moved in his spirit. That word means to be angry, or to warn, or to scold, or to be indignant. And the translators often, especially in the history of the English translations, have not known what to do with that, because it doesn't seem befitting for Jesus to be at the tomb of Lazarus and to be angry, and maybe then to be crying from his anger because he's about to weep. But it does make an interesting difference if that word does mean that Jesus became so angry in this moment that he was overwhelmed. Because I don't think he would be angry at Mary for being frustrated with him. And I don't think he would be angry at any of the people here. It makes me wonder, if he is angry, is he just angry at what he's watching? The power death has to devastate human beings. Angry at how long this has gone on. Lifetime after lifetime, ended by death in a way that just overwhelms him. In fact, it reminds me a little bit of how Jesus speaks to the demons that we talked about last week, where there is a little bit of a sharp tone he has with the demons. And he's not ready to deal with the demons finally yet, but when he encounters them and he sees the damage they're causing to people, it affects him. He has compassion on them. He cares. It bothers him. And so he acts in those specific cases, and in doing so, he shows what he's someday going to do to the demons and here to death. To say, there are people that death is hurting. And I don't like that. It makes me angry. Now you might say, well, maybe it's not anger. Maybe it's just being overwhelmed, being upset, being greatly moved. In either case, I think we can definitively say that he cares for the pain of these people who are overwhelmed by death and its consequences. I hope it gives us, by the way, we have some here who are in moments of grief and who have lost people close to them just in recent days. And I hope that this gives some measure of comfort for us to all know that God sees when we hurt and that it affects him. He is not just blind to that. He does not just say, well, get over it. Dust yourself off and move on. He weeps with us. Verse 38. Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So Martha protests the taking away of the stone, as I mentioned. Going to the grave and saying, "Hey, come look at his grave," that's one thing. But taking the stone away, that's going too far. Why do you need to go in there? What's this about? In fact, it seems that Martha's probably concerned that there's going to be some kind of shame or embarrassment that comes either on Jesus or her brother or both. And Jesus rebukes her a little bit. He says, "Just believe. Trust me, and you'll see God's glory." We've already talked about this. When I asked you, "Do you believe this?" you said, "You believe that I'm the Son of God who's come into the world." That's what you believe. So can't you trust me that when I say take away the stone, it's not going to be to your shame? Verse 41. So they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me." I love this about Jesus. Jesus says, "I'm going to stop right now. Tomb open and pray to God so that everyone here knows what's happening, that I'm not some kind of charlatan who's got some confederates in different places, that I'm doing this by the power of God and that God sent me, that I'm not just an independent agent, but I do the will of my Father." Verse 43, when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out. And the man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, unbind him and let him go. So he speaks to Lazarus, and Lazarus begins to walk out of the tomb, covered in the grave clothes that they had. I tried to find, by the way, a picture. You'll notice I just have the stone rolled away from the tomb picture. There are a lot of pictures, like a lot of artwork of raising Lazarus. Some of them seem to happen in a church, which is weird. This is obviously not in a church. But most of them have Lazarus looking like a mummy. And I don't think that's what's happening here. They did wrap the dead in grave clothes. And obviously his legs are bound in some way, so he's probably shuffling out. And Jesus says, get rid of the clothes and set him free. Unbind him and let him go. Earlier in John, Jesus said, truly, truly, I say to you, an hour is coming and is now here when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. Do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming when all who are in the tombs will hear his voice and come out, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of judgment. All who are in the tombs will hear the voice and come. The day is coming, Jesus says, when all the dead will be called out. Lazarus is just the beginning. He's just one of the first proofs of that. I especially want to emphasize that this is about hearing the voice of the Son of God. Hear his voice. That same voice, that same word that we talked about weeks ago, where Jesus says to the paralytic, rise, take up your bed and walk, and suddenly a paralyzed man can rise and take up his bed and walk. That same voice with which Jesus can rebuke the unclean spirits and say, come out of him, and they obey him. Now that same voice, Jesus says, will be used to call forth to all the dead, and they will come out of the grave. There will be resurrection. When Jesus speaks, it is with this earth-forming, storm-calming, mind-bending power. This is who he is. This is the power his words hold. And when you open this book and read those words, whether they're in red or black or whatever, remember that. These are not mere words. They are words that all of heaven and earth conform to. He upholds all things by the word of his power. Lazarus comes forth, and amazingly, probably more shocking than the miracle itself, some people don't believe when they see it. In fact, there are some, it says in verse 46, who go and tell the Pharisees what had been done. And they decide that they're going to plot to kill Jesus. And also, an interesting little wrinkle in chapter 12 and verse 10, it says they plot to kill Lazarus also because Lazarus was living evidence that a miracle had happened. That's just a reminder, by the way, that miracles don't make all our questions go away. They don't fundamentally change our hearts. And that just because we have more information doesn't mean that we want to do what's right. Because there are people who watch a dead man walk out of the graves and say, wonder how that happened. Better go tell on it. So what can we take from Lazarus's raising? I want to give you three ideas here, and then I want to talk about how this might change us in three ways. First, death is not the end, it appears to be. We've traced this throughout the lesson. Mary and Martha say, you know, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died. Disciples, by the way, are only concerned about their own deaths in this story. If we go, we might die. Then you've got the other people who are standing around saying, could this man who opened the eyes of the blind, could he have possibly prevented this? And yet no one says, oh, I bet he's going to raise him from the dead. No one is expecting a resurrection because that's not the way it works. Death appears to be the end. Even the Pharisees' reaction after the miracle shows that. Because they're saying, look, we can deny a lot of stuff, but you can't deny when a dead man comes back from the dead. He was 4 days dead. What can you do with that? Death is a line for us that we cross and we don't cross back over from. It just doesn't happen. And yet, here comes Jesus, who has no respect for that way of thinking. Death is just another line, another frontier he can cross. Paul says, in the presence of God, the God in whom he believed, talking about Abraham, who gives life to the dead and calls into existence things that do not exist. And I love it when Paul says this, when he is giving a testimony, a defense of himself. Why is it that thought incredible by any of you that God raises the dead? Why would we think that God has so much power, but you know, his power stops at the grave? Once we die, there's nothing God can do. It's God. And yet we consistently have this view that death is the end. It is the end for us of our connection to a person, it appears, our relationship with that person. And to undo death is the domain of God alone. And yet here is Jesus showing that death does not have to be the end. And so, probably the most obvious idea I could draw from this is that Jesus holds power even over death. I know that's what he wants us to take from this story because he tells us so. Look again at verse 25 of John 11. In verse 25, Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live, and everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die." He says, I have the ability to raise the dead and to give life. And he proves it. You know that verse 25 is true because Lazarus walks out of the grave. So you know Jesus holds power even over death. So you and I, we can go to the graveyard and we can yell at those graves all we want. And we can call to our friends and our relatives and say, come out. And we know that nothing's going to happen. We have no power in ourselves to do that. Here is Jesus who has different power than any human being. Jesus is not threatened by death. Remember, Jesus seems angered by death. Death makes him frustrated, deeply moved in his spirit, greatly troubled. And yet he exercises his power over it as a down payment on the time to come when he will end death. And that leads to the third idea, which is that resurrection is a foretaste. You're probably aware that Jesus raises several people in the course of the gospel accounts. He raises Jairus' daughter. He raises the son of the widow of Nain. In fact, we even know that when Jesus dies, the graves are opened and many people are raised from the dead that are not even directly healed by him. But I want to say something. When you read those stories of resurrections, I want to caution you. Don't just think, oh, those guys were really lucky. They're the ones who got what we would all like to get or what our family would be blessed by. Jesus did something awesome for that guy. Instead, I want you to think of this as a foretaste. What's to come? Remember, we read this earlier, do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming when all those who are in the tombs will hear his voice and come out. All. What we would call a general resurrection. Everybody going to be raised and sent to their fate. Someday, Jesus will speak and all who are in the graves will come out. I wish I had more details about that, don't you? I wish I knew exactly what that would look like. Paul talks about our body being transformed to be like his glorious body. Wish I knew more about all of that. I don't have all the answers on that, but I can trust that Jesus knows what he's doing. Because when I read stories like this, he shows he knows what he's doing. He has power over death. And even Jesus' own resurrection, where he rises from the dead, is intended to be taken as a foretaste of what's to come, not just a one-time event that's one guy at one point in history was raised from the dead, and then we all go back to dying and staying dead, but instead a foretaste that Jesus has broken death. This is 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 23, "For as in Adam all die, so also in Christ shall all be made alive, but each in his own order, Christ the first fruits, then it is coming those who belong to Christ." I hope you hear that. The first fruits language is harvest language. The first part of the harvest was Jesus, but there's more to come. That's not the end of the harvest. So the first part was Jesus. He came out of the grave. And yet when he comes back, he says, those who belong to him will be raised like he was raised. Because Jesus was raised, we know he can make good on the words he says. So it's a shot across the bow of the power of death. Death will not reign over human life forever. It will not. Jesus has shown us. There is power here. So So God is beginning something new in Jesus, in which death is conquered and destroyed, and its sting removed and its power undone. So I want to spend the last couple of minutes here just asking the question, well, what changes when we know that Jesus is the resurrection and the life? And I just want to give you three quick ideas here, and I want you to take these home and kind of chew on them about how our perspective and our actions change when we know this about Jesus. First, when we know that, we live differently. If death has lost its sting, specifically, we don't have to fear death anymore. Do you remember how we read about Jesus' interactions with the disciples? How scared they were? We don't want to go down to Judea because we're going to be killed. And then only reluctantly does Thomas say, all right, let's go and we'll die with him. They live in fear. Jesus is not afraid. He says, no, we're going. We got some things to do down there, and I know I'm following the Father. Of all the things we fear death the most. And Jesus has shown us that he controls death. Therefore, we don't have to fear it. This is the text that Mark read for us this morning, Hebrews 2. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, in other words, since we have bodies, he himself likewise partook of the same things. He became a human, that through death he might destroy the one who has power over death, that is, the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. Have you considered how much human beings are lifelong slaves to the fear of death? Sometimes it means that we just avoid thinking about it and talking about it. Sometimes it means that there are things we want to do or should do that we refuse to do because we're too afraid. We spend our time trying to make death's sting less or trying to live in denial about what's going to happen to us. But early Christians, I've said this before, early Christians were known for going and tending to those who had diseases when the pagan world was too scared of the disease. Early Christians were known for standing up to powerful people who wanted them to do things that were wrong because they did not fear death. They feared something bigger than death. So in other words, they lived differently. So I'm not saying that we should be reckless with our lives. I am saying that sometimes our fear of the unknown paralyzes us from doing good. And Christians live differently. Second, when we know Jesus is the resurrection and the life, we die differently. As we approach death, we do so with confidence. Paul said, "For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain," which means living is serving Jesus, but dying means departing and being with Jesus, he says, which is far better. So I'm good with it. Either way, I'm good. Paul says, I'm already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Henceforth, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing. You think he's scared? He knows he's about to die. He says, all right, well, I did my best. Serve my Lord. I know what's coming next. Sure, there were things to fear in Paul's situation, but there's no doubt. He knows where he's going, and so he dies in a different way. I've had the blessing of, in some time preaching, being at the bedside of Christians as they neared death and sometimes as they were about to die. And I have to say, it was a tremendous encouragement to me to be there, particularly as a younger man. Not that I'm not younger now, but you get my idea. Christians who approach death with quiet confidence. Christians who worry about, well, what's going to happen to my family? What are things going to be like without me? But not worried about themselves, not scared, not I don't know what's next. And as a young man watching that, it made a deep impression on me. Not everybody dies that way. I want to raise a question. If you're present in our audience, or if you're watching online, and you are not a believer in Jesus, do you have any hope as you face your own death and mortality? How will you approach that moment? Will it be with abject terror? Maybe just you only believe that there's just nothingness after death. Does that give you any solace? Do you believe that there might be good in the way Christians face death with confidence because they believe in something bigger and higher than themselves? And if so, maybe there are some things to reconsider about your own view of the world. Christians die differently. And third, we grieve differently. We grieve differently because we know what Jesus has told us and taught us about death. When we see our loved ones and our friends die, we don't take it the same way. This is 1 Thessalonians 4:13. We don't want you to be uninformed, brothers, about those who are asleep, that you may not grieve as others do who have no hope. That there is a way that the hopeless grieve that does not befit a Christian. We have hope. And so we don't grieve the same way. We don't grieve as if our friends and loved ones are returning to the void. We don't grieve as if they have ceased to be and become nothing. We don't grieve as if this life is the only fellowship we have with them. We know that we will see them again, as Paul goes on to say in 1 Thessalonians 4. And that makes our grief different. It still hurts. It's still hard. But it's not the end. And we learn that as we watch this man walk out of the tomb. That if Jesus has this power, then there is more to come. And that future raising will bless all of us. So this is the hope that Jesus gives. That death is not the end. That he has broken death. And he calls to you. And he says, I am the resurrection and the life. Do you believe this? He calls to you because you may be slaves to the fear of death today. And it may be that you say, I don't have any answers for this. This is beyond what I can do or change. And so he calls to you, come to me and I will give you rest. Jesus is the one who gives hope. And so we invite you to him this morning. This is the part of our service where we like to sing a song and we'll stand up and we want to encourage and invite anyone who is here and is ready to make a commitment to turn their life over to the Lord Jesus and to become a disciple of his, to make that known to us. We'd love to help you do that. And the way we do that is just to invite you to come down to the front and you come talk to us about what you want to do and what the next steps are. We'd love to have that conversation with you this morning. And it may be that you say, no, I don't want to do that right now, but you have questions and concerns. And we'd love to talk to you about that. But please don't let this moment, don't let this morning pass without seeing who Jesus is and responding to his call. So can we help you this morning? We invite you to come to the